Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's been a busy time at the Institute, tonight we have Gabrielle Carey, who is well known to you, I guess, but I'll introduce her. Gabrielle Carey was born in Sydney and published her first co-authored book, Puberty Blues, at the age of just 20. She then travelled and lived in Ireland and Mexico for several years before returning to Australia. Gabrielle Carey is the author of fiction and non-fiction books, including In My Father's House, The Borrowed Girl, and So Many Selves. And currently she's teaching writing at the University of Technology, Sydney, but also writing herself. And Gabrielle Carey is here on the occasion of the publication of her most recent book, Waiting Room, a memoir, which is just out. And tonight Gabrielle is going to talk for us on In Trouble Again, The Perils of Memoir. Gabrielle Carey, many thanks. If anyone can't hear, just let us know.
Thanks very much, Jared. Now, it's a curious phenomenon, but a very human one, that we don't learn from experience. If we did, I would have stopped writing memoir 30 years ago. I would have learned after the publication of my very first book that writing based on real experience almost always lands you in trouble. Although Puberty Blues is not classified as a memoir, when it was released, everyone knew that it was based on reality and real experiences. We changed some names, created a few composite characters, rearranged incidents and events to serve a storyline, as most writers do, but the strength of the book was its basis in reality, its basis in truth. And where did that get us? In trouble. In very deep trouble. Not only with parents, neighbours and friends in the Shire, now ex-friends, but with the entire country. In a way that would be hard to imagine now, the publication of Puberty Blues caused a national moral outrage. Some of you may remember, most of you don't, but I certainly do. People were incensed that we dared to tell tales of teenage sexuality and surfy culture. Radio interviewers, TV chat show hosts and publicity agents, almost without exception, treated us as though we were liars. Many parents simply refused to believe what we said. It might be true of other people's teenage children, but not theirs. What right do you have to write such a monstrous book? One audience member demanded during a live recording of the then Peter Couchman show. How did we land ourselves in so much trouble? We had written about reality, as memoirists do. Afterwards, when Kathy and I went our separate ways, she chose the sensible path and turned to fiction. I, on the other hand, stayed with the real. Not a choice I would recommend with hindsight, but choice, that word so beloved of our age, is a word about which I have always been very suspicious. Although the Puberty Blues trouble was probably the most infamous of my perilous memoir moments, it certainly didn't stop there. With each book, I learnt that the part you worry about, where you mention someone's mother in a not-so-flattering light, perhaps the part that makes the publisher's lawyer so nervous, turns out not to be the part you should have worried about at all. And that the person you decide not to mention by name because you know how they feel about their privacy is the person who comes up to you later asking why she was left out of the story. And that the person you were certain would be thrilled to have their name mentioned turns out to feel insulted and unconsulted and exploited. Even when you've sent this draft manuscript round to everyone you possibly can so they can compare their memory of the event to yours, and even when they say, yes, that's the way it happened, there is always someone who won't be happy with your version of events. So, when I wrote a book about my experiences of visiting jails, for example, a prison officer sued for defamation because the person I remembered and wrote about, a sadistic key jangler, was not what he remembered, a man just doing his job. When I wrote about my father, my sister was offended because what I remembered, a flawed but still lovable father, was not what she remembered, a selfish obsessive who neglected his family. And when I wrote my reminiscences of the times surrounding the publication of Puberty Blues, I was accused of writing a one-sided memoir. is there anything such thing as a multiple view memoir, one has to wonder. Despite these problems with attempting to write reality, I've stayed with the real because that's where I felt I belonged, where my strengths, if any, lay. And because when it comes down to it, I believe that all literature is rooted in the real. Even the revolutionary fiction of James Joyce is based on personal experience and actual people. When Joyce was asked, for example, why is Bloom portrayed as a Hungarian Jew, he answered famously, because he was. And as Richard Ellman, Joyce's biographer, wrote, Joyce was never a creator ex nihilo. He composed, recomposed what he remembered. And herein lies the problem. The recomposing of what the writer remembers. The biggest problem with memoir is just that, the fact that it is based on memory. And memory, as we all know, is a slippery sort of witness, perhaps the original unreliable narrator. Because memory doesn't work like a computer or a camera. The act of remembering isn't like reaching into a filing cabinet to retrieve a document. A human memory is not a neat, accurate recording of an event. Although based on historical reality, memory doesn't completely encompass reality. It selects and modifies. How you remember also depends on the way you feel at the time of recollection. In the process of remembering, our memories fictively rearrange reality. Maybe you could call this creative remembering. Maybe it's the reason why I often find myself in trouble when I take these imaginative reconstructions and write them down, because my reconstructions are not the same as other people's. Which is why when I wrote my most recent book about my mother, I wanted to get it right. Or as right as one can ever get these things. To that end, I gave a copy of the manuscript to my mother, as well as my son and daughter, long before it went to publication. They all approved, although my 12-year-old son insisted I pay him embarrassment money because of the scene I'd written about him in the bath when he was 8. And my daughter insisted that I add something sexy about her because she thought she came across as a nerd. My mother, in her typically mysterious and inscrutable way, responded with one sentence, "Yes, that's how it happened." Well, at least that was a confirmation of my memory. But was it approval? I wasn't sure. In any case, I knew I couldn't pursue it any further. I couldn't say, but how did you feel about it? Because my mother wasn't one for talking about feelings. As I go into in the book, she came from a fairly severe Protestant Scottish background, and they don't do a lot of talking about feelings. Which was why, when I finished the book, I found myself faced with a new kind of memoir dilemma. The dilemma was about whether to leave my manuscript in the bottom drawer, thereby preserving my mother's intensely guarded privacy, or publish and thereby give public testimony to a great woman. I was very aware that my mother, who had worked just as hard as my father in the area of peace and social justice, had received little recognition, and I yearned to provide her with some sort of acknowledgement, not just for her good works, but for her good life and good character. And yet I wondered, was this really about my wants rather than hers? And I debated this dilemma for some 5 years, at first making the decision I couldn't possibly publish, and then finally deciding that on balance the book would honour my mother rather than embarrass her. But my decision was too late. 5 days after the book was launched, my mother died. Had I examined my conscience for too long, taken my scruples too far, it would have been one of the greatest thrills of her life, one of my long-term friends commented. Or was it better all round that she was saved from the sometimes brutal experience of the public gaze, not to mention the insensitivity of certain reviewers? Is there ever any decision that is absolutely right and beyond any doubt? In a recent commentary in The Guardian, Madeleine Bunting wrote that research into the human mind is beginning to show that we have much less control over our lives than we thought, and that much of our decision-making is really made by unconscious habits of mind. She describes the ideal of choice as the great sacred mythology of our time. Which brings me back to the life of a memoirist. Does anyone really choose to be a memoir writer, or a writer of any kind? The idea of choice conjures the image of a school leaver who has been advised by a careers counsellor that, given her strengths and weaknesses, she's perfectly suited to a life that has no definite career path, no structure for promotion, no annual bonuses, no performance indicators, no social life, no professional support, and no possibility for retirement benefits or superannuation. Although it does provide plenty of opportunity for finding yourself in trouble, both personally and professionally. One has to wonder who would actually choose this way of life, which is why, after all these years, I've decided to renounce my vocation, to give up my long-held vice of writing memoir and retire to the creative writing classroom. And what is the first rule we teachers tell our students about creating a successful story? The golden rule? For your story to be interesting, I tell my students, your character must be in trouble. Here's the equation, character plus trouble equals plot, which is an equation that is a lot easier to learn than, say, writer plus memoir equals trouble. So before reading just quickly one or two excerpts from the book, I'll give you a little context. It's a story of realising that my mother at the age of 80 is suffering increasing memory loss. And then we discovered that the cause of this is a brain tumour. But this took quite a long time, not because the symptoms weren't there, but because we, her children, just didn't want to see them. She'd been healthy all her life. We'd dependent on her. We just couldn't imagine that there'd ever be anything wrong with her. When I didn't sort of start out thinking this is the book I'm going to write, I'm going to write a book about my mother, I started writing the way that I always write, as a way, as Joan Didion says, as a way of understanding how I was experiencing something, to understand how I feel about something, how I think about something. I have to go through the writing process to sort of to come to those kind of understandings. And when I got to the end of the book, I realised that that it wasn't just a book about my mother. It was really about three generations of women, or three generations, that is, my mother, me and my daughter. And it was also about the situation that many of us find ourselves in middle age, which is looking after elderly parents at the same time as looking after children. So I'm going to read one section that... it was just one of those typical sort of days where I'd been at the hospital all day, or I'd been looking after my mother all day, and I came home and I was, at the time I was caring for my rather difficult 15-year-old daughter and my rather boisterous 8-year-old son, and they weren't very impressed with the fact that their mother suddenly wasn't there for them. And because my mother had been there for me all my life, I obviously felt very guilty about not being able to attend to both in a way that I would have liked. So, home late again that evening, I immediately sensed that both the children were in a sulk. It was partly my fault, of course. I had conditioned them to expect their mother to be on call, within reach, always available. I'd let them come to expect this because that was what I had learned to expect of my mother. She was always there when we got home from school, waiting to serve afternoon tea, hot pikelets with melting butter and jam. Then my brother and I would go outside and play cricket, using the corner of the neighbour's white picket fence as the wicket. It's only now that I realise the relish with which I look forward to those afternoon treats. If it wasn't hot pikelets, it might be pancakes with lemon and sugar, all homemade, of course. I knew nothing of packet mixes until I went to high school. I remember marvelling at other people's kitchens, the benches lined with appliances, electric mixers, waffle makers, sandwich makers, even ice cream makers. The makers in those houses were all machines, not mothers. And there were no wooden spoons, no handheld egg beaters, no tin flour sifters, no old weighing scales, no embroidered tablecloths or linen serviettes. As a mother, I had automatically modelled myself on my own mother, maintaining the afternoon tea ritual, feeling this was somehow essential to childhood. So my children naturally felt resentful when they arrived home to an empty house. "Where have you been?" my daughter interrogated when I walked into the lounge room. "I'm hungry," whined Jimmy from the sofa. Jimmy had come to rely on his regular banana milkshake and plate of quartered pear on his arrival home from school. "Oh, you poor little baby," Bridgie turned on her brother. "No more peeled pear for you. Mum's too busy now." It was pure jealousy. Bridgie resented the fact that her brother was still served after every afternoon and she wasn't. But this was only because I could find nothing to offer her that she would agree to eat. Normally, Jimmy, robust and cheerful, was usually impervious to Bridgie's taunts. But he immediately burst into tears and looked up beseechingly, clearly wanting me to reassure him that afternoon teas were not forever finished. Of course, it wasn't the pear. It was what the pear symbolised. If my children were unfed, they immediately felt unloved. And although Bridgie might not like my offerings, she still wanted the opportunity to reject them. I quickly rustled through the cupboards for dinner ingredients. As I busied myself silently in the kitchen again, I recognised myself in my mother. Feelings were not expressed verbally within our family, so food often became a substitute for emotion. Although she never articulated her affection in words, each night she offered up meals as emblems of her love. Food became a talisman, invested with magical power like a Eucharist. Through those crumb cutlets, through that mashed potato, through that lemon pudding, we three children intuitively understood that our mother was repeating, night after night, like a holy incantation, "Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my life, my energy, my love, which I have given up for you." And there was I, frying garlic, boiling pasta, in an attempt to broadcast the same message to my children. I knew that they would have been perfectly happy with a pizza, but it wouldn't have had the peeled pear factor. As I quartered the tomatoes and diced the onions, I began to consider the possibility that cooking was a skill that was gradually being lost, like handcrafts. I wondered if cooking your own food might one day be viewed as being as otherworldly and quaint as sewing your own clothes. Only a generation ago, most women could run up a shift on a Singer sewing machine. My own mother had smocked our dresses and even sewn our underwear. Nowadays, I can barely thread a needle. Hand sewing has almost become a lost art. I recall the story I'd heard about the Romans so famous for making bricks and roads, how after all that bricklaying and empire building, they suddenly forgot how to do it, forgot how to make bricks, forgot the technology, as though someone had suddenly lost the recipe. Perhaps it was the beginning of the downfall of the Roman civilization. Did that mean it was also possible that an entire culture could forget how to cook? Yet, even as I was grating the parmesan that evening, contemplating the downfall of Western civilization due to the demise of cooking, and vowing to stay true to my mother's fusty ways, I realised that my shopping list for the next day included a reminder to buy a ready-made meal for my mother. And this was because my mother, who had taught me so much in the kitchen, about the constant stirring of custard over a low heat, about grating fresh nutmeg and how to spice a fruitcake, had, like so many others, completely forgotten how to cook. And that's my reading. I'm not sure where we're up to. I've got maybe a little moment to read one other bit.
You got time.
Yep. And this is the section that if I can find it. My daughter decided that I had to. As I said before, she thought she came across as a nerd. She certainly didn't. I actually picked this up. I forgot to bring a copy of my own, and I had to kind of go and rustle through my office and find a copy of Waiting Room. And I found in it a postcard of my daughter. So you can see she's not a nerd. She's quite stylish and gorgeous. Anyway, so this is more a kind of a picture of my relationship with her. And it's only a couple of pages. That afternoon, Bridgie arrived home and went straight to the kitchen. I followed her and sat on the table while she ate her peanut butter on toast. "So, how was school?" I asked, a standard question with the expectation of a standard response. "Today we learned how to put condoms on bananas," she announced cheerily. "What?" I was shocked. How could this be? She was only 15. Then again, when I was 15, I was already on the pill. "And we also talked about STDs," she said. I looked at her inquiringly. "Sexually transmitted diseases," she translated. "Haven't you ever heard of them?" "The advice from the professionals is that you should talk to your teenager about sex, be open, give them information, talk about the need for protection and staying safe. I know this is right in theory, I just can't seem to do it in practice. For months I've been meaning to have this talk, the talk that has to be had, but for some reason I couldn't do it. I'll do it today. I've been promising myself day after day, week after week. I'll have that talk this afternoon. As soon as she gets home, I'd tell myself." But that afternoon, I realised that the opportunity had arrived, the perfect opening for the talk. "Seize the moment," I told myself. I sat down at the table. "Now, Bridgie," I began. But then I stammered. I had no idea where to start. "What's wrong, Mum?" Do you want to talk about sex? Is that one you want to talk about? Sex? The words seemed to slide around so easily in her mouth as she watched me shift in my seat. Why was I so uncomfortable? Perhaps because my own mother had never had this talk with me. We were not the kind of family to discuss bodily functions openly. Yes, I answered. She laughed and started singing, Mum can't talk about sex, Mum can't talk about sex. She was right, of course. It was that problem I had with the physical world, that unease. Bridgie didn't have it in the least. She didn't seem to be any of that, there didn't seem to be any of that estrangement between body and mind that my mother and I both suffered so acutely. Her body did exactly as she wanted it to. She was her body was hers. What's more, she even enjoyed her body, particularly her budding sexuality. I had repeatedly refused her pleas for pole dancing lessons. Her revenge had been to announce that her ambition in life was to become a Playboy bunny. I just don't want you to have the same negative experience that I had, I said. I don't want you to get pressured into sex. If you're going to do it, I want it to be because you want to. I was thinking of her boyfriend, her first real boyfriend, how they regularly disappeared into the bedroom and closed the door, not emerging until hours later. He seemed nice enough, polite enough, but you just never know. I was wondering whether a proper mother would insist that the door be left open, or whether that would simply force them out into the night to some empty park. I couldn't help wondering whether her practice putting condoms on bananas at school was being applied in real life. I continued, I want you to be able to say no. I know, Mum, was the response. She'd heard it all before. She went to a girls' school where the female teachers were upfront and direct, trained sex educators, professional communicators, expert talkers, unlike her mother. But how much did she know? And did I really want to know how much she knew? Wasn't it part of her right as a separate individual, as a grown-up in the making, that I not know? Perhaps teenagers are entitled to a few secrets and lies. I mean, if they told us everything all the time, if they were completely honest, there really would be something wrong. On the other hand, maybe that was being irresponsible, just an excuse for being in denial. Parenting could be so bloody confusing. Had my own mother ever felt as befuddled as this? I turned to her. I know you know, I said, hopeful she knew more than me. Things aren't like they used to be in your day, you know, she assured me. Good, I said. I'm glad. I know more than you knew. That's good, too. She got up from the table. And now I've got homework to do. Was that it? I wondered. Was that the talk? Is it that easy, or did I miss something out? We hadn't talked about AIDS or HIV. We hadn't talked about pregnancy. We hadn't talked about orgasm. Thank God. Perhaps I needed to get some professional advice. I walked into the study to look for my to-do list. Call parenting helpline. In fact, what I really needed was the how to be a responsible parent of infant age children and difficult adolescents and also look after aging parents hotline. The yellow pages, however, didn't seem to have that entry. So that's my response.
Well, thanks, Gabriel Carey. I didn't know you could ham it up so well.
I started off on the feet.
You say you're shy, but you're not shy. So we come to question discussion. We'll finish no later than, but before, almost certainly before 7. I haven't read this book yet, which I've only just got, but I read your book on your father, and I read your recent piece in the Melbourne Age. And I think you said there about the book on your, essentially on your father, that that you'd reassess your father, which is what, some 20 years after his death. Now you're writing essentially about your mother, but about your children as well. I mean, do you think, looking back, and you're young enough, in 20 years' time, whether you might reassess your mother?
Oh,
but just talk about just talk about what you, you know, your reassessment of your father, because obviously that's a simple. You come back up here.
Okay. All right. Well, as some of you may know already, my father suicided when he was 64, and it was very sudden, and I hadn't seen him for a number of years, and I had come back from overseas with my firstborn child, Bridgie, who I've just showed you the lovely photo of, and wanting to show her off to the grandfather, and I got to the airport and got this terrible news. So, and that led to a book in my father's house, and there was, you know, I think it was, I suppose, I haven't read it for a long time, so I don't know what it's like, really. But I suppose overall it's still a loving portrait, although it was, you know, it was a search for it. It was a way of trying to understand what had happened, of asking questions, how, where did this come from, so on and so forth. And I suppose what Jared's referring to now, 20 years later, that I have decided, because I've had such a long time to think about it, and such a long time to also observe the effects of suicide on family and friends, that even though this is quite a harsh line, that I do think essentially suicide is a selfish act. And I think, and someone did say to me somewhere along the line, you know, that often people who suicide are doing it out of anger or revenge. And I think there was certainly that sort of motive with my father. So, and I suppose that, yeah, my reformulation of my view of maybe him, but also of, you know, generally of suicide, I put into a piece in The Age, which had a lot of response from people being very angry. I suppose, in a sense, I was taking up the side of the people who are left behind, and that we, you know, I want people to understand that there's a lot of suffering involved with the survivors of suicide. And so, about my mother, she's not such a complicated, complex and tortured person as my father. And also, but wasn't trying to... You see, my poor father was trying to prove to the world that he was a good person, or that he was trying to change it, or had an incredible expectations of himself, which he then also put onto his children, which I'm still trying to kind of deal with. And my mother was sort of the opposite of that. So I don't see myself in 20 years' time changing my view very much on her, but that's, we'll see.
Gabriel's, most of you will know, but Gabriel's father was... Now that's Kerry, the prominent academic at UNSW.
Yes, I just want to say something. As I get into extreme old age, things are happening with my memory that didn't before. Mm. And the other day when the name McGurk came up, I remember the very tragic family I knew when I was about five, or, you know, my childhood. And I remember that I said something really cruel to this little boy, Bobby McGurk, which must have hurt him, not hurt him, but hurt his mother, who was only about four. And, you know, pops into your head is the nasty things you did. The time you went nice to your parents. I mean, boy, they're getting their mind back on you in old age, because things pop in that you... And, I mean, a judgment of my mother that as a child I accepted. I now see her behaviour was very cruel. It's just some things open up with a... You know, you don't ask them that it happened. It just happens to you.
Mm.
I hope you think well of me.
I'm rather interested at the moment at the number of women in the writing field who are reflecting on their mothers. I mean, Susan Vargas coming to speak in a few weeks, and her mother tragically died.
Mm.
She'd written about her mother earlier in Hetty and Me, but I mean, this was more a kind of where does she and I belong together in our lives. And Summers has done a different kind of book,
that's true,
trying
yeah.
to reconnect with her mother.
Mm.
But what is it about mothers and daughters, and why is it, I feel, sometimes that we get to respect or honour, feel that we need to honour our mother or reassess our mother later in our life rather than...
Well, probably because we treated them so badly when we were young.
Give me a little scenario on how you see that. Why do we do that then?
Well, look, I was a shocking teenager. Is it in that book or in the other one? I can't remember where I talk about how, you know, I think that, you know, Bridgie, when she was younger, gave me a terribly hard time. But then I think it's in this book, and then I compare it to what I did to my poor mother, and it was nothing. And it's, in some ways, it's seeking forgiveness, I think, and seeking redemption. And, you know, this book was really, I honour you, I love you, mother, I want to give you this gift, because what sort of a gift can I give her? I can give her a book. I wrote a book that was dedicated to my father, and I wrote a book that was dedicated to my daughter, and now my son said, it's my turn.
Gabrielle, you've been a practitioner for a long time in terms of writing.
I'd know how to do it by now, wouldn't you?
What techniques have you developed to improve the memory that you need to represent reality in the future?
Oh, dear.
What sort of things have you done to skin yourself up?
Well, isn't it funny? You should ask that question. I've mentioned that my mother had terrible memory loss, and one of the things that... she died in April, and one of the things that I heard from people who have been with someone when they die and are grieving them is that if, say, they died of a heart attack, then that they get sort of pains in the chest, and my mother had this terrible memory loss, and I feel like I've just had this terrible memory loss ever since she died, that I've kind of taken it on. So I don't think my memory's improved, and I've never sort of tried to think, okay, I've got to improve. I've never been to an improving memory course or anything like that. I do think that writers are born with a certain way of remembering, and there's a lot of things that are left out, but they remember scenes and emotional qualities to scenes incredibly well. And this was really highlighted recently when I got a letter from Randolph Stowe, who's many of you will know is one of our most well-known writers. He was a friend of my mother's, and that they grew up together, and in fact the families, he was almost part of my mother's family. And so I wrote to him when my mother died, and he wrote me a few letters. And one of them, he talked about coming to Australia in 1950, and a scene where he went to visit my family, and where he described a scene between my father and my big sister. And you would have thought he'd seen it yesterday. And he described my sister at 5, and it was like a psychological portrait of this woman who is now 56. And he had somehow managed to find a scene that encapsulated her character and my father's character in this letter, 50, 60 years later. And I just thought, that's a writer's memory for you. I'm not being very, very clear, but writers do have a certain way of recollecting.
The interesting question then becomes, what predisposes you to that? Is it stress? Is it relaxation?
Oh, I think that, what does the Irish writer say? Is that anyone who has a tortured childhood can become a writer? I mean, there's something about the childhood, there's something that happens in childhood. And I've got a theory about mine, which is that my mother and father were both from Protestant backgrounds, and my mother particularly from this very Scottish repressed background. There was never any talk of emotional sort of discussion, and it's partly why my father turned so vehemently to politics, because it meant that he could always talk about topics, and we never had to talk about how we felt or any. And there was, and there really wasn't any sense of intimacy at home, and there wasn't certainly any articulation of feelings. Now I was this, incredibly emotional, not oversensitive, but sensitive, I suppose, child, and I felt all these things that I absolutely understood were not allowed to be said. What could I do about it? The only place I could go was to put the words on paper, and I'm certain that that's how it happened. My daughter says that I'm still like that I still can't talk. was one of the discoveries. I had thought that, you know, I was completely different from my mother, and I was a communicator, and I was effusive, and I could be articulate. But my daughter says, yes, well, you are about a lot of things, but about that, when it comes down to that sort of really basic, intimate level, you know, she says that I avoid it just as much as my mother and my father, and that in fact she finds out lots of things about me from my writing, not from me directly. So that was sort of one of the discoveries that I found when I was writing this, trying to pride myself on being kind of liberated from that Protestant background, and not so really.
I just wondered, when you're writing a book for publication, how you experience the tensions between exploring things that are fascinating to you, but thinking about how am I going to make this interesting for everybody else, or do you just make it you and then assume that everybody else will be interested?
Oh, I never assume that everyone's going to be interested, but I think most writers write for themselves. Apart from the Dan Browns of the world, I mean, obviously there are people who are writing for commercial reasons, but all the writers that I know and the way that I've written all my life is because you feel compelled to do it. You wouldn't do it otherwise. Why would you do it? There's nothing in it, you know. You feel compelled, you feel driven, and that is the reason why you write. And there's something really satisfying about, it's frustrating as well, but there's something wonderful and about the creative process. When you get to the book, it's kind of good, but it's not as exciting as actually doing it. So you have all these discoveries and things along the way, and my books right from the beginning. With Puberty Blues, I remember when we were writing drafts of it when we were 17 and telling stories to people, oh, you know, we're writing this book about Sylvania, and they looked at us and said, who's going to be interested in that, you know? So that's the answer to your question. I mean, you have to write what you're passionate about and what you're interested in, and yeah, there's no other, that you don't really, again, it's the choice thing. I don't have a choice. I don't think, should I write this really interesting story that people would be interested in about vampires, or should I write something about my mother? That isn't a choice for me. There isn't a decision there. It's just what you're driven to write. Mm.
I've been writing about my life as the wife of a diplomat for many, many years. And most of it is bizarre, quite funny, and it's amazing how after a long time you can dredge back memories and they come to life, and you can tell the people who were involved in it, do you remember that time in Indonesia when, so do you remember what you said and what you did? No, they don't. It's amazing how people, I can remember and it happened, but they don't remember at all. So should you go ahead and write it? I don't know.
Ah, yes, well then, that's one of the classes I do in my non-fiction class. It's one of those ethical dilemmas that you can talk about for hours. But it's interesting, when they say they don't remember, I think if you press them, you'd get something out of them. Going back to your question, I wasn't really right when I was saying that you don't train your memory. You do.
For your own prison.
And I do an exercise with my students where I say, go back to the earliest memories, and they all, oh, I can't remember anything from that early. No. And I just said, look, just think of one thing, doesn't matter, the school lunches that you had when you were in second class, just start writing about that. And it happens without fail that it's like Chinese boxes, they start writing about the school lunch, oh, and then they remember the school teacher, oh, and they remember the school uniform, and it's amazing how these things open up. So you do... You can go into your memory and there'd be another little door, and you go in there and there's another little door, and it leads you down all these passageways. But a lot of the time I think we choose not to remember, and that's partly what this book's about as well. My mother was a great one for choosing not to remember, because there were a lot of unhappy things that she wanted to choose not to remember. And I'm like that as well. And we all have these little blind spots and black bits where we go, right, we'll censor that out because it's too hard.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan once said that, someone told me, he said to him that some of his clearest recollections are of events that never happened at all.
That wasn't a joke.
It wasn't a joke. Because this man was telling Reagan that he'd met him on a film set when he was a boy, and Reagan was in this film, and on this location, the Greg and said, well, the film was filmed at that location, but he was never on that location, and the bloke got very embarrassed. This was at a public function in Washington, but Greg said, never mind, said, from my clearest recollection of events that never happened to. Now, where are we going? Now, before I get to you, have I missed anyone? Have I missed anyone? I have. There we go.
Yes. To what extent do you think do memories actually change if you, that what you experienced as a child, don't you reinterpret it as you get older and see things in a different light? So maybe if you wrote your first book when you were 20, if you rewrote those events now,
well,
they will turn out to be totally different.
And that's why it's so important, I think, too. I mean, it's funny with reality. I mean, you've got to have some distance to be able to write about it, but you can't have too much distance either. I occasionally go back and read a book that I've written, and I say, for example, I wrote a novel. Again, it was based on real experiences, my experiences when I lived in Mexico, and I can't remember writing any of it, and it just reads like someone else has written it. And but that's great, you know, and there's no way I could write that. I could have written that book, you know, in a year's time. It had to happen in that period that it happened. Yeah, everything's got its moment, I suppose.
I should have mentioned that Jenna Grundy's got some copies of
Do you? It's not so much a memory thing, not so much for prompting the memory, but do you keep a diary that you read, not so much for what has happened really, but how you saw things and what was important to you?
Well, I've got an embarrassing pile of diaries from when I was in my teens and early 20s, but then, because I was writing all day, or often, and writing every day, the last thing I wanted to do was write again at night. So, although I'm very strict with my students and tell them they have to keep notebooks and they should keep a diary, and I don't keep any of those things, and that's because I don't. It's my work now, so I wouldn't. And I'm not interested in my own. I don't want to write down what I did today. It was pretty boring, you know. So I think that'd be very dull if I wrote my diary now.
Stuart, you mentioned Joanne Didion.
Yeah, Joan Didion.
Yes.
Sorry, yes.
Which other people have you admired their memoirs? Have had an impact upon you?
Oh, I went through all my memoir period in my early 20s. I don't read a lot of memoirs. That sounds terrible, doesn't it? I was just saying to someone, I'm because I'm working full time teaching now. I spend most of my time either reading student work or reading books related to what I'm teaching. So I'm and when I'm not, then I'm a bit of a James Joyce obsessive. So I tend to read James Joyce or around James Joyce. So I go through, you know, little stages, and that's, I've been in a James Joyce stage now for about 10 years. I'm kind of stuck. I've got a Finnegan's.
Yes.
Well, I've got a Finnegan's Wake reading group, and we only worked out the other day that if we do, you know, if we keep going, we'll be all dead before we finish it. So we're at the rate we're going. So that keeps me occupied.
Did you pick that up in Ireland, that interest?
No, strangely enough, and this is funny, I've just written something for a new critical collection about Dubliners, and the bit that I wrote was about the naive, what I call a naive reading of James Joyce, because I first read him when I was 20 or 21, I'm talking about the short stories here, and I was completely knocked out by them. I just thought they were incredible. But I could still, what I thought now, looking back, now that I can see what they represent and I can see all the symbolism, and I'm much better and much more mature and analytical and critical reader, I can see all these layers and things that I couldn't see then. Even then, they were wonderful things to read, you know. So anyway, so then I went, yeah, then I kind of, it took me a long time to read Ulysses because it's a bit hard to read. And it was only because someone suggested, and this was only about 10 years ago, I kept saying, well, look, I'd love to read it, but I keep trying and it doesn't work. And she said, well, you know, you get it on tape or you get it on CD and you put it in your car. And so then I heard it read. And then I moved on to Finnegan's Wake. And once you move on to that, that's the kind of... that's the end of you, really.
It's terrible.
Now, we're about to wind up, so, yeah.
Interesting point that you're in Mexico and you know the author, Pedro Páramo, the very famous novel, was asked, when are you going to write your next book? It was very famous. And he said, I'm not going to write another book. Everything I've had to say in my first book. Do you think you'll ever get to that stage?
Oh, each book's my last book. This is definitely my last book.
That's a good answer. Don't tell your son. Yes.
If you were going to write fiction, imagine you were writing fiction about your mother, would you want to sort of somehow take her in an area she didn't go and have consequences to that? Can you imagine yourself, you know, what would be the difference? I mean, I've just read Emma Bovary again, and I thought, he said... Emma Bovary saying, wow, how on earth could it be him? And put all that in the book when she's doing the wrong thing all the time and making the wrong decisions. I mean, when you're writing the book, surely, you know, you aren't actually you. You've got to be you.
Okay.
Giving yourself a freedom. All right, shut up for me.
Well, I mean, yeah, she had to be doing things wrong. She had to be a character in trouble, didn't she? Or there'd be no story. I love Emma Bovary. I don't, in a way, she did things wrong, but
yeah, exactly.
In the right way or something. Yeah, I've got every sympathy with her.
Okay, many thanks. Take a seat. That's your book with your daughter's photograph. She's not shy. On her own postcards at the age of, what, 18 or something?
She was, no, it was just, she was working for Sucre and they asked her to come and do modelling for them.
She looks great. But as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Waiting Room, a memoir. Gabriel and I think, had a disagreement about her book about her father, and she wrote to the Sydney Morning Herald about this. And I liked the article that she wrote, but I thought a book about a father was terrific. We disagreed about certain material in the book, but I thought the book was a terrific book, and I look forward to reading this book, Waiting Room. And it's great to have Gabriel along, who's a well-known writer and now an academic, but has written a number of very important books that will be around for a long time in Australian literature. So it's great to have her here today. The paper will be published in the Sydney Papers online. It'll be up on our podcast tomorrow, and I wish you all the best with Waiting Room, and I think your son deserves a volume of his own.
Yes.
Dedication. So I think there will be another one. But for tonight, thanks for a great presentation. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.